I'm Scott.
And I'm Julie.
And this is the Good Story is Hard to Find podcast.
Yes, where two Catholics talk about popular books and movies they love and the big themes they see underneath of the one reality.
Yes, and this one has a lot of big rocks in it.
This is not exactly what I would call a popular book either.
Mm-hmm. Ah, although I think so.
It should be.
Yeah, it ought to be. Yeah, this is episode number 15. And we're going to talk about East of Eden by John Steinbeck, which I had a truck deliver to Julie's house. And I think she liked it, though. What did you think?
Yes, I about 75 pages in, 100 pages in, I had to write to Scott and say, how should I have that crow cooked that I'm going to eat?
Because oh, that's good.
Yeah. I am actually really enjoying this. I was traumatized by The Red Pony when I was in school and forced to read that sad, sad story. And 600 pages of Steinbeck wasn't looking good. But actually, this, I understand now why people who like his other stuff evidently complain a lot about this book, because they say it's too big, it's too sprawling, it's too rambling. And
I haven't read everything that he's written, but this is one of my favorite books of all time. It's I really like it. Yeah, the Grapes of Wrath is his other big one, and there are similarities, but Grapes of Wrath is probably harder.
Isn't it much more of a downer?
I mean, it is a downer because what it's about, you know, the Dust Bowl and the Depression, and the people in there go through tougher things than these folks do.
Which is a little hard to imagine.
They're worried about survival, you know, in Grapes of Wrath, you know, so it's really difficult, you know, with a family trying to survive, you know, so
Well, and this book is specifically, it's East of Eden, it's based on the book of Genesis, and so there are a lot of hard themes, but ultimately, just like the book of Genesis, although people might not think of it that way, it is about love, and it is about truth, and it is about hope for the future.
Yeah.
And he does, I think, a really good job of intertwining those themes with the family story that we see. And as Scott said last time, it's multi-generational, which is like Genesis, but it's not a blow-for-blow retelling. He's reimagined it, and so the echoes are there everywhere, and I will say that my markers, and I've got a significant number of them for all these points of the book that I thought were interesting, start at about chapter 15, which is after, and then we can talk about the story, but that's after Adam and Kathy have moved to California.
Ah, okay.
And the first part of the book is much more what I would think of as a Steinbeckian idea. Not a lot of hope, not a lot of understanding of each other, not a lot of love shown in a way you can understand, and a lot of mean people because of it.
Let's talk just quickly about the book of Genesis, because I think it would be helpful at the outset, because for me it seemed that the biggest thing that he was playing with was the story of Cain and Abel.
Yes.
And that became kind of a recurring cyclical thing throughout the book. Like, you know, two or three times it made me think of Cain and Abel with different sets of people.
Mm-hmm. And welcome to the story of the human race as told in Genesis. And I think that's why we all identify with it, because that's our story.
Right.
And I think that's maybe... which is going broader than you probably want, but I think maybe that's why people can talk about original sin, because there's that thing in us that always is discontented somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exemplified by the story of Cain and Abel, comparing yourself with somebody else, wanting the love of the one who's greater than you and not getting it maybe. Mm-hmm. And you do or don't understand why, and you feel insufficient. I mean, that all goes into Cain and Abel, and we see it throughout Genesis, and I only talk about this as if, well, I'm an expert on Genesis, but...
Which you are. You are a resident expert.
Well, I am steeped in the book at the moment because on Forgotten Classics, which is my solo podcast, I have been reading the Robert Alter translation and commentary, which I can recommend to anyone. It's so interesting and insightful.
Mm-hmm.
And
yep, sure is. And well read, I must say.
Oh, are you listening? Thank you.
Yes, you bet.
Okay.
Yep, I'm a few episodes behind, as in like five, but I am catching up.
It's awkward to read the commentary, and it's probably kind of awkward to listen to it. And I would say anybody who wanted to delve into Genesis, even if you just want to delve into it as a book, because I was asked to read it by, I think the person who asked me was an atheist, because they said they'd never read it, and they knew it was integral to Western civilization and culture. Mm-hmm. And so they were interested in hearing about it, and I had just read this translation, and it's fairly new, I think from 1999 or something, and Robert Alter and his publisher very kindly gave us permission to read it aloud.
Mm-hmm. That's
but
neat.
Mm-hmm. When I read it, and then I'll stop talking about the translation, That's but a- when I read it, it made this book and the people in it come alive for me in a way that I actually found myself crying a couple times over characters I'd never noticed before. Hmm. And for the very reasons that we see echoed in East of Eden, seeing how they were affected by the lack of their parents' love, which is kind of interesting now that I think about it. Mm-hmm. Esau especially.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's amazing, you know, as we go through these stories in the Bible, how sometimes it strikes one as different. Our priest in his homily this last week was talking about Jesus, and he told a story, you know, about these guys who were throwing a net into the water and pulling out, you know, they didn't have any fish, and then Jesus comes by and says, throw it in one more time, and They pull it in, it's got a bunch of fish. And he says, and then they dropped everything, and they followed Jesus. And mm-hmm. he said, and what did they see in him? You know, it's almost, you know, put yourself in their place. What did mm-hmm. they see that made them say, I need to follow this person, you know? Well, and it's like, you know, we personally search for that same relationship, you know, today. And if you don't,
right.
you know, so it made me think of something in a different way, because, you know, at that moment I was thinking, you know, okay, well, I am one of those people throwing the net in. And mm-hmm. you know, what would it take for me to follow that person? And it made me think of it differently. So, you know, it's the same with this book, making me think of Cain and Abel in a different way,
mm-hmm.
because they'd become not just these two guys in Genesis, but they became people.
Yeah, I really felt an empathy for Cain that I had never felt, although... I don't, and we may or may not talk about this, but I don't think Steinbeck had it exactly right when he was talking about his ultimate idea of why God rejected Cain's offering. But, and I'm torn. I want to go down two paths. Really mm-hmm. quickly, Cain okay. and Abel, most people should know this who are listening.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, it's basically they're Adam and Eve's sons. And they each, one of them is a farmer, and one of them is, I guess, a shepherd, mm-hmm. I suppose. I was going to say a rancher, but that's mm-hmm. the Texas in me coming out. and they each bring God offerings. And Abel's are accepted, and Cain's are not. And Cain does not take this very well, and he finds his brother and pounds him into the dirt and kills him. And, of course, God knows and makes him admit it. And then sends him off into the wilderness. And the thing that this book mentioned to me that I never thought about when they're because they actually talk about this story in a central part of the book of East of Eden, is that people think of the mark of Cain because he marks him so that people won't murder him or anything.
Mm-hmm.
They think of it as a bad thing because it's a murderer's mark. And in one sense, it is. It's warning you. But on the other sense, it's God protecting Cain. God saying, I love you enough to let you try again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's his sign of love. I'm not going to kill you.
Yeah.
So I thought that was interesting. But the other thing it made me think of is just last night, I was at our, it used to be a Bible study. Now it's turned into looking at the new liturgy that's coming up. We're going through the bishop's video, and our priest will stop and talk every so often, and he's so amazing. But he was talking about what is faith. And I started writing all this down because I was thinking of our talk today. But everybody's like, oh, believing in things that aren't seen. And he goes, well, that's some of it. But what he wanted to get at was that basically God is self-revealing. He comes to us first in a personal way that's real, intimate, interested, committed. And he said, he isn't interested because he needs us, but just because he loves us. And wow. So mm-hmm. his revelation mm-hmm. is through relationship. And for every single person, it's in a different way. And it made me think about the book of Genesis and also this book, because both books are entirely about relationship.
Yeah.
Relationship between two brothers, relationship between people and God, relationship mm-hmm. in families, between other countries. But it's always the thing that they can't get just for snapping their fingers is the relationship with God. He's got to come to us. And then when we respond, that's faith. Hmm. That's the acknowledgement of the relationship.
Oh, that's nice. Yep.
Yeah. And so when I thought about that, that adds the personal dimension to Genesis and also to East of Eden. And because Genesis then just follows man kind of in his development of his understanding of God. And I was trying to look for a good explanation of the book. I was looking through Peter Kraft's You Can Understand the Bible. And he does tend to go on sometimes. He'll look at what each book is about, and then he'll talk about like underlying meanings. And he kind of says the same thing. He says that God reveals himself through words and deeds. The deeds are both supernatural and natural, miracles and providence. And it says he always selects his special instruments. Abel, not Cain, Noah, not everybody else, Abram, not Lot, Isaac, not Ishmael. You know, he mm-hmm. always is picking someone, the Jews instead of the Gentiles, until Christ comes, which is, of course, the New Testament. But he says, then he and Christ's church spread it to everyone. But God's providential care preserves and educates and creates Israel to be like a womb, like a mother for the Messiah.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. And so Mary having Jesus, then Jesus is the fulfillment of everything that Israel was about. So he was saying also that Genesis kind of looks primitive, or the Old Testament can look primitive, but that's because we were all taking baby steps in how, when God comes to us, as we grow in our understanding of who he is. So if sometimes it's being interpreted as him being callous or cruel or judgmental without mercy, it's because our understanding isn't enough to see both sides. And again, I found that illuminating for thinking about East of Eden, because in the relationships, Steinbeck is kind of taking it that one step further, so that like I can understand more of how Cain feels through like Charles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In Adam and Charles's relationship, which is the first set of brothers in the book.
Right. Yep.
And there's only one person ever presented in here who's not understandable on some level. And and that's mm-hmm. a girl named Kathy.
Right?
I'll just put snake on her name and move on.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
So I'm sorry, I've just been sitting here.
No,
and
that's terrific. That was all great stuff. And this book, you know, makes me think those kinds of thoughts throughout the entire thing, which is why I love it.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
I'm going to get a copy of it.
Oh, good.
That's how far you converted me. I'll just say it here, everybody. He Yay. Was right. All right. I was wrong. Yeah.
So the book itself is, it starts off on the East Coast. There are two brothers, Charles and Adam. Actually, it starts when they're young. Mm-hmm. It seems like a long time ago. I was like, wow, yeah, they were young. Genesis. They were young at the beginning of this book.
Yeah, and the father, it told about the father first.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you're right. It did. Yeah. Yep. And I don't remember his name.
Caleb? Cyrus?
Okay. Was he brothers too?
They don't talk about
okay,
that.
I couldn't remember that. That. Okay.
He was born on a farm. Oh, he was an only son.
Right. Okay. And that's an interesting thing, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I'm looking back. It says his mother ran the farm. He was born 6 months after his father was mustered into a Connecticut regiment in 1862. And she embraced a primitive philosophy or theosophy. She felt her husband would surely be killed by the wild and barbarous rebels. And she prepared herself to get in touch with him in what she called the beyond.
Wow.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. This is Adam Trask.
Okay.
This is Cyrus. Okay. So they don't talk about, they just say Cyrus was an only child and then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this is a minor part of the book, but it's just interesting to me.
Yeah. I'm
just trying to make the connections now that we've read the entire thing, making the connections back. It'd be worth rereading the whole thing probably.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So the, Adam and his brother Charles are, kids in Connecticut. And they grow up, and then Adam, he goes off to war and also ends up in prison for a little while. But he goes back to the ranch or farm, and he's discontented with his relationship with his dad and his relationship with Charles, who...
Mm-hmm. His brother, who stayed at home and farmed.
Right, and who played out the whole Cain and Abel story earlier in his life, you know, their lives.
Yeah, one brother was, Adam was gentle and kind and thoughtful, and Charles would protect him unless he felt threatened by their competition, in which case he would literally pound him into the ground, and if he killed him, well, that's how it worked. Mm-hmm. He didn't, but
yeah,
wow.
Yeah, there was one incredible scene where he beats Adam up, and Adam, after he's left alone, Adam goes to hide because, you know, for some reason he does so. And it's a good thing he does, because Charles comes back looking for him with an axe.
Yeah.
And because Adam's hidden, he never finds him.
But it's made pretty clear that Charles ultimately is jealous of him because he feels like his father never loved him and he always loved Adam more. And Adam never understood that until a conversation he and his father have. So, because the father was difficult to understand.
Right. And he was, yes.
Yeah.
And then, I don't know, should we just gloss over the entire plot, I guess?
Yeah, let's just gloss over the, the big picture you were telling.
Okay, so then Adam, he, as adults, Charles and Adam live on their farm together for a long time, and they go through these cycles where they're able to live with each other for a while, and then Adam's just got to go because things are getting bad. So anyway, after a few of these cycles, Adam decides, you know, he starts to talk about going to California.
Right.
And then this girl named Kathy comes into the picture, who is a very emotionless, cold, conniving, very meticulous.
Yeah, she has
planner,
no,
I guess. Yeah,
she has no empathy,
none whatsoever. Yeah,
I mean, she's one of those. I mean, these days they would be trying to work with her with therapy and medication, which, in my, from my knowledge of people like that, and I know one, wouldn't work. But good luck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
she has her own personal story that is told. And then when her parents die, I guess, you
don't
know, I don't know how spoiler. Yeah.
Yeah, don't spoil it.
So when, so when that family comes apart, then she ends up at their farm, kind of in rough shape. So she is taken care of by Adam and Charles. But Charles immediately knows that this is a bad deal. And, but Adam, for some reason, decides that, you know, hey, this is a good thing that we ought to be doing, and actually falls in love with her.
He He idealizes her.
Exactly. He doesn't fall in love with her. He falls in love with the idea of being in love and having a family.
I guess that's it.
Yeah. So, but
I never understood that.
He wants it so bad that that's, you know, this was presented to him and he's like, well, this is, you know, probably from heaven, you know, and I
and I guess.
Yeah, it's so anyway, he ends up taking Kathy to California. They leave leave Charles behind. So, but Kathy doesn't want to go to California, but then she goes ahead and goes anyway.
Well, she's kind of stuck because she's really hurt at first, mm-hmm. so she can't get away. And then she just goes with him out of convenience.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a way out. It's a way out.
It's a way out. And then she feels like she can leave and she finds out she's pregnant, I guess. So then she's stuck until mm-hmm. she has the baby.
Right. Yeah. So west they go. They go to the Salinas Valley, which is lovingly written about by John Steinbeck.
I just realized if I could insert one thing, mm-hmm. That's the first thing he writes about.
It is, yeah.
I'd forgotten that. He mm-hmm. does this wonderful description of it and then talks about some of the history of the people who've lived there. And then he talks about this Hamilton family
mm-hmm.
and then drops them for a lot of the book. So I'd forgotten all about it, but it's like that presentation of here's the setting of the Garden of Eden.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Here's the world into which all this is put. And here's a family that kind of lived in the Garden of Eden
because right,
they live in California. Because
I should have made that connection. Yeah.
No, I didn't.
It was odd when you're reading it, you know, he talks all about the Salinas Valley and how amazing it is and flowers and all this stuff. And then now we're in Connecticut.
Yeah. And he talks about the Hamiltons and what the, you know, these people are like. And then he leaves it with Samuel and Liza, who are the people that Adam will later encounter. But I didn't think about it. This is the thing where the rereading comes in, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, oh, looking back, oh, Garden of Eden, and here are kind of like God's people put here.
Yeah.
And Liza and Samuel are kind of like those two types, both good, just different types of people.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Expressing, you know, that love and that being kind of God-fearing or connected with God somehow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So anyway.
Yeah, and Samuel, they meet Samuel pretty quickly after they get to California, and Samuel Hamilton is a large part of this book.
He's kind of the heart of it.
He is, yeah. Although, you know, the heart of it Lee. To me is Lee. Yeah, that's Lee. What I was going to say. Because I love Lee.
Who wouldn't?
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
Lee is mm-hmm. their Chinese servant, Kathy and Adam's Chinese manservant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they hire him early on.
Yeah.
And he's with them for the entire rest of the book. Mm-hmm. And you know, he's Alfred from Batman.
Yes, the wise man who drops a word of wisdom when it's needed.
Mm-hmm. And is selfless and mm-hmm. he's good. He's just a good man.
But he's very much inspired by Samuel also. They're friends. They both love to read. They share books.
Mm-hmm.
They understand each other so that when there's a central conversation that's had, and I guess it's a little later in the book, but where they talk about the story of Cain and Abel, sorry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they're kind of delving into it more, and they are both fueling each other. You can see that excited kind of conversation that people have when they're just intellectually sparking off of each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so to me, I think it's like almost they're like folded hands. So the fingers are intertwined. Those characters, I guess Samuel's handing off to Lee, or they both work together to help each other understand more.
Sure. Yeah.
So we don't get to see Samuel as much, and he's a different style of person than Lee, but they're both. Lee is the continuation,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of the heart.
Right.
So anyway, sorry mm-hmm. to interrupt.
No, that's okay. If I just continue the bird's eye view without spoilers, what ends up happening? Oh no, don't be sorry. What ends up happening is Kathy has the babies, and by babies I mean twins.
Yep.
And then leaves, and Adam is brokenhearted and empty shell of himself, and One of the coolest scenes in the entire book is when Samuel finds out that those babies don't have names, and it's been about a year.
Yes.
And he goes to the ranch to make sure that they're named. And I'd like to delve into that one just a little bit more, but let's just finish the overview. So the babies are, the names that they're given are Aaron and Caleb, right?
Yeah. I love the way they're named. Yes.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
We'll talk We'll talk about that because it's cool.
Yeah.
Okay. So now the story is really about these two, and they're twins. They're not identical. And then they grow up and play out their own Cain and Abel story. So Adam and Charles were Cain and Abel, and so are these two. And and that's, you know, my opinion. You may differ with that, but I think that that's...
No, you're right.
Okay, that's what goes on. And then they grow up in the Salinas Valley, and I don't know how much more to tell other than it's really about those two and their mother... They're told that their mother died and all this stuff, and
she went off to run a whorehouse.
Exactly, yeah.
And it tells about how she, you know, comes to do that, and the kind of the position that she holds in that society, because there are three whorehouses and they serve these various purposes, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
There's the one you went to if you're happy and wanted to laugh, and I mean, just like, okay,
yeah.
Yeah, because then what happens is they both meet a girl that they're both interested in when they're very young.
Yeah, very young. They show up during a rainstorm, and her name is Abra.
Yeah.
Yep. And Aaron immediately wants to marry her. Aaron is the brother that everybody likes just because, you know, there's no real reason. He's like Joseph. Everybody likes him best, but there's really no... exact reason, you know, he's better looking, speaks more plainly, whatever it is. He's
a little sweeter and nicer, and he's more dreamy. And Charles kind of has this edge.
Cal.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. Yeah, and he's got this edge, and he's always worried about how bad he is. He's constantly talking about, you know, I'm not good.
Which I loved that about him.
I did too.
He's so self-aware that...
And Lee told him, hey, just the fact that you're thinking about that means you're not.
Right.
And oh, there was a great... Yeah, we need to start getting into details now, because all of these little pieces of excellence are what this book is.
Right.
You know, the conversation between Lee and Caleb about Caleb saying, you know, hey, I'm bad, and Lee telling him, hey, you don't take the easy way. You're not going to be doing excuses. You know, you say you're bad, you know, you're still responsible.
Finish the summary. I have to talk about that too.
Well, the summary is pretty much finished because these boys grow up and they fight. They move to
not the way that Salinas, the first ones did,
and they move to a town called Salinas. So they're not on the ranch all the time,
right?
But they go ahead and they move to Salinas, and
then I guess it's about the interaction of their family with Samuel's family, and one of them goes off to war and the other one stays home, because by then it's World War I in the book. And and then it's the passing of the torch to their generation.
Right.
Yes. Because then it's all detail at that point. There's not a... But okay, so then can I talk about...
Oh, yeah, go right ahead. Yes, please.
I guess everything from now on is spoiler territory.
Yeah, we better say that. But it's okay. You know, this book... is magnificent. I don't think you can ruin it. I think that actually knowing a little bit about it on your first read is probably a great thing, and you'll get more out of it.
Yeah, I would say don't be afraid of Steinbeck the way I was, because this isn't what I thought it would be. You know, my kids both had to read The Pearl twice.
Oh, yeah.
Both of them, and they hated it.
I love The Pearl.
Yeah, well, you know, can I say? Yeah. they both hated it. Maybe
that's
because
right.
I think they felt like it was too fatalistic or something. Anyway, you know, I never had to read anything else because The Red Pony, which, you know, nobody should have forced on them. So sad.
Yeah.
And the sad stuff tells you a lot, but I have to be tricked into it. Or you know, like in this podcast.
Oh, yeah, we talked podcast? Early on when you were starting to say, you know what, I think I kind of like this book. We were talking about Kathy and how heartless she was and how she's kind of a representative of the serpent in the garden in this book. And then you said something about how, you know, the character is not very satisfying if, you know, there's no chance of redemption.
Oh, that's Flannery O'Connor said that. Yeah. Okay.
But then you said, but you were realizing that all of the other people in the book, it's almost a backdrop against which the other ones play. Did you feel that way once you finished it? Because, you know, Samuel and Lee are, you know, a complete contrast to Kathy. And I think that without Kathy, you don't have Samuel and Lee.
Well, Samuel and Lee, to me, are like the prophets. They're like the good prophets who they're searching actively for more of a relationship with God and to understand him more. And they're almost in that Hebrew or Jewish style of knowledge is the greatest good, because with knowledge, we understand more of who God is. Mm-hmm. And we can't love him unless we understand him more. And so that's why that conversation that they all have about Cain and Abel is such the heart of the book in a way. And then Kathy is, she's the snake. I mean, she's perfectly evil because she can't even understand what good is. And that's made clear in three different places. I mean, Steinbeck makes sure we can't miss it. Adam tells her twice, and it's when Charles meets her and tells her that. And she can't touch them. She can't make them upset or afraid. And all she understands is that. And when that's made clear, she despairs and goes away for good. And I looked at that and I thought of Judas, who his sin was not so much that he betrayed Christ, which is a huge sin, but he would have been forgiven, but he despaired and killed himself. I thought about, you know, Satan and Dante saying that the nine circles of hell, the circle in the middle is ice, because without the love of God, you're frozen. Because you don't even know what warmth is. And the cold wind is coming out of Satan's mouth. And I was like, man, is that like Kathy or what? All she understands is how to hurt each other. And they always talk about how she's very cold. Or at least that's what I seem to remember. And so I was like, okay, so these are basically personifications of these qualities. But we know people like this. I mean, people who are born without empathy, that's why they have such a problem. And because people expect to be able to relate to other people on that personal level. Someone can choose to make bad choices, or they can be so twisted by their bringing up, maybe, which we see also, that they make terrible choices because they don't have a good view of what reality is. But Lee and Samuel do.
Right.
They have that much more proper perspective. So they act as the moral anchors for everybody.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that. And
And what I thought was interesting about, if I could diverge for a second, about what you were saying about Cal, which is there was Aaron and Cal at the end, and you're talking about how he keeps saying he's bad, and Lee said, you know what, the fact that you're saying it, don't worry about it. And he has this one point where it's made really clear that he and Charles from the beginning are bookends, because each Charles and Cal,
Caleb, or Aaron and, are you talking about Adam?
I'm talking about.
You're talking about Aaron and Caleb. And
Charles. No, I'm talking about the first brother who was dark.
Oh, okay. I'm with
Adam's brother, Charles. I'm sorry, I'm being unclear. No. Adam's brother, Charles, who's the darker one who has these rages he can't control.
Yeah, who Caleb never met.
Caleb never met him.
Right.
But Caleb also will have these rages that he sometimes controls and sometimes doesn't. He never is as bad as Charles. He's much more close to being a good person, but he senses that darkness inside of him. Both of them have incidents where they give their father a gift that they think is a wonderful gift. They saved up a lot for it. It's totally unappreciated.
Mm-hmm.
The father barely acknowledges it in one case, and in the second case, gives him this speech about why it's a terrible gift.
Yeah.
Which I didn't even understand, but mm-hmm. I'm not that character.
Mm-hmm.
And in both cases, they go away feeling full of rage and rejected. And of course, Steinbeck's making this point over and over and over. We're all looking for love. And when we're not accepted and we're not loved, we become bad
mm-hmm.
because that badness is a cry for love. And so at this point, Charles doesn't try to fight it. He brings it up over and over. But Cal is thinking about it right after he's been rejected. I don't know if you have the book. It's
mm-hmm. yep, I've got
page
it here.
538 to 539 in the Penguin edition, mm-hmm. which is what I got from the library. But his father loves Aaron more. I'm jealous. That's why I'm so bad. And I'm trying to buy his love. And then he goes and he says, why don't I just leave? They wouldn't miss me. And he says, does Aaron have to fight himself like this? I don't think so, but how do I know? I could ask him. He wouldn't say. And he's been going on and on, and it says, Cal's mind careened in anger against himself and in pity for himself. And then a new voice came into it, saying coolly and with contempt, if you're being honest, why not just say you're enjoying this beating you're giving yourself? That would be the truth. Why not be just what you are and do just what you do? Cal sat back and sat in shock from this thought. Enjoying? Of course. By whipping himself, he protected himself against whipping by someone else.
Mm-hmm.
His mind tightened up. Give the money, but give it lightly. Don't depend on anything. Don't foresee anything. Just give it and forget it. And forget it now. Give, give, give the day to Aaron. Why not? He jumped up and hurried to the kitchen.
Mm.
And so I guess that was right before he gave
the
gift.
Yeah, right before, yeah.
I had that timing wrong. But the thing was, is that that's the voice of God. That's, yep. You know, you look at it, you go, is that evil or is that good? But by making him be honest and face the truth about how he was being self-pitying and making it all about him, he realized that, yes, the gift was to buy favor, but that's not the point of the gift. Mm-hmm. The gift is to give the best you can and then don't worry about it. Now he then still has to struggle with himself a lot, because we all do. And he makes some wrong choices, but they're never as catastrophic as Charles.
No,
who won't take, we don't see into his mind, but he doesn't take any outside guidance. And he's constantly fighting with himself. And I think that's so honest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we all fall into that. We all want to curry favor either with other people or with God, and that's to me was what Steinbeck missed in the central conversation everybody had about why God didn't accept Cain's gift.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think one of the things that I realized in, it might have been Robert Alter's translation, but I think I'd seen it mentioned before, is it always talks about, I think Abel was the shepherd, I guess, must have been.
Mm-hmm.
Abel brought the firstborn, or the firstlings, which means the best. And it says, Cain just brought, you know, an offering, a fruit, or whatever it was. But mm-hmm. it wasn't the finest. It wasn't the best. He wasn't sacrificing anything. He wasn't giving everything he could.
Mm-hmm.
He was just kind of like trying to get by.
Right, right.
And so what God did was say, that's not enough. You're not coming up to the mark, and you know it. And instead, he took it out on his brother instead of admitting. I was trying to find the spot. If it says it here, come on. Yeah, it says, mm-hmm. Cain brought from the fruit of the soil an offering to the Lord, and Abel too had brought from the choice firstlings of his flock. Mm-hmm. And the Lord regarded Abel and his offering, but he did not regard Cain and his offering. And Cain was very incensed, and his face fell. And the Lord said to Cain, why are you incensed, and why is your face fallen? For whether you offer well or whether you do not, at the tent flap sin crouches, and for you is its longing, but you will rule over it. Now I'm reading from the Robert mm-hmm. Alter translation.
Okay.
But that's so clearly played out in this book.
Mm-hmm.
And the different choices that you can make between the two sets of brothers and the counsel they receive and the upbringing they receive. Because even when the second set of boys don't have their father's love, and you'd think, considering his bad father, he'd be a better father.
Yeah.
Oh, but he's awful.
He is awful. I mean, he pretty much checks out when Kathy leaves.
Yeah, and then even when he checks back in, he doesn't even start thinking of his kids as people till they're like 10 or something.
Yeah.
But they have Lee.
Yes, they do. They have Lee. And Lee, yeah. And they're in pretty good shape with Lee.
Yeah. And Lee helps. So,
yeah.
Because after Kathy leaves, Lee takes over running the household and kind of looking after everybody and being everybody's best friend.
I'm curious, what does your translation say about that that word, let's see, that became central to everything?
To Michelle or...
Yeah, so long after they have this conversation about Cain and Abel, and that's Samuel, Lee, and Adam. Adam's the father of Caleb and Aaron. Long after they have that conversation, they have another conversation, and this is Samuel and Lee. And I can't remember if Adam's in there or not.
I think Adam is there, because otherwise...
Oh, yeah, Adam had to have been there, right? Because Adam knew the word, right? So... Right. So, Lee's talking about how he was really touched by the story. So he looked it up and he read, in one translation of the Bible, he read, a certain part of it. And in another translation of the Bible, he read a certain part of it, and it had two different meanings.
Yeah.
So let's see here if I can find that exact thing.
Let's see.
Yeah, do you have that in front of you?
And do thou.
Let's see. Well, I've got this part here. So that, you know, there's 16 verses in Genesis. Okay.
Oh, this says you will rule over it.
Right. And yeah, I'm looking for the part where he says, you know, hey, this one's different from that one.
Oh, that's page 303 of mine.
Okay.
But do you want me to...
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, do you want... What are you thinking of? Just the part...
Well, the... okay.
After
here it is.
Years,
I've got it. I've got it. Okay.
Okay.
So he says... this is Lee. He says, there was only one place that bothered me. The King James Version says this. It is when Jehovah has asked Cain why he is angry. Jehovah says, if thou doest well, shalt thou not be accepted? And if thou doest well, sin lieth at the door. And unto thee shall be his desire, and thou shalt rule over him. It was thou shalt that struck me, because it was a promise that Cain would conquer sin. And then Samuel nodded. And his children didn't do it entirely, he said. Lee sipped his coffee. Then I got a copy of the American Standard Bible. It was very new then. And it was different in this passage. It says, do thou rule over him. Now this is very different. This is not a promise, it is an order. And I began to stew about it. I wondered what the original word of the original writer had been that these very different translations could be made. So then Lee goes to his family house in San Francisco and brings this translation to these older gentlemen and says, what do you guys think of this? And their response is to learn Hebrew. Because they're so interested, they actually delve into it. They learn Hebrew, and they translate it themselves after learning Hebrew. It took them like 2 years to do this process. And now I'm picking this up a few pages down the road. Don't you see, he cried, the American Standard Translation orders men to triumph over sin, and you can call sin ignorance. The King James Translation makes a promise in thou shalt, meaning that men will surely triumph over sin. But the Hebrew word, the word timshel, thou mayest, that gives a choice. It might be the most important word in the world. That says the way is open. That throws it right back on man. For if thou mayest, it is also true that thou mayest not. So in the Chinese translation, or these folks' translation, they decide that it means thou mayest and not thou shalt.
Right. Right. And this says you will rule over it.
It says you will. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. And
it's funny because when I was looking back at it and I was thinking, yeah, the way Steinbeck talks about it is so perfect because he's talking about free will. But when I read it just now, I was looking at it again and I was thinking, but for you is its longing, that's sin, but you will rule over it. And it wasn't like, I guess Lee and his fellows were saying that they felt that meant it's a promise. But for me, that just meant kind of what they're saying. Mm-hmm. You can do it. I promise you that you can. Mm-hmm. Not that you will, but maybe that's because I have a different relationship to all of it. Because I know I won't always do it because I'll choose wrong sometimes. But you can if you choose right and want to make the sacrifice.
Right, right.
So, but that's why this was so important.
Yeah, and it turns out to be important throughout the entire book. It comes up it's from that point on. It's like this comes up.
Maybe I'll read this section. I read a little story from this book that I really enjoyed that was just kind of...
Oh, and I listened to that last night. It was great.
Oh, did you like that?
Oh, yeah. I loved it.
I was like, it's just this great little story, and I think it's about Steinbeck's actual mother. Because at one point, he puts his family in here.
Yeah, and that is an odd thing. Every now and then, he slips into first person. And I think he does at the beginning of the book to tell people who the narrator is. So he's saying that, you know, way down the line, I'm the son of one of the Hamiltons, right?
He's a grandson.
Olive Steinbeck was Samuel's daughter. And we've talked about Samuel. And she married somebody named Ernest Steinbeck.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, because they say at one point, I didn't really think it was... He was really putting himself in the story until he said so-and-so showed up and said, is, you know, Ernest Steinbeck here? And they went, well, no. And I was like, oh.
But, and then he talked about himself in third person, which was odd. He said, John and someone else. I can't remember the other person.
Yeah, peeked
from behind the skirts of his mom.
Yeah. And so
he was talking about himself in third person.
I know. So that was kind of fun. But I was thinking, maybe I'll read this central section and put it on Forgotten Classics bit of lanyette because I encountered this years ago on a blog called The Paragraph Farmer that Patrick Hannigan, or is it O'Hannigan? I can never remember. I'm sorry, Patrick, because I think he listens. Sorry.
Oh, what a cool name. The Paragraph Farmer.
Isn't it? Unfortunately, he's family life and everything has put the pressure on him, so he's had to stop. But I featured it on Happy Catholic. And so what I'll do is I'll go back and look for that, and maybe I'll post it here.
Oh, good.
On a good story. But I'll read it as a bit of lanyap and put it on Forgotten Classics. And I'll link to it if people want to hear it instead, because it doesn't ruin anything. And it is such it's a wonderful look at not only his storytelling, but at the importance of real understanding and furthering you in relationship and in mission and in freeing you, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, yeah, it's all about the relationships. And if I could talk about Samuel for just 1 minute, he was somebody who I admired greatly, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the moments in the book that I just loved was he and Adam had a kind of a difficult relationship. There was one point when Kathy left Adam, Samuel and Adam kind of had some difficulty there too. And it resulted in he would brood about it because he would worry so much about it that it affected his home life. So Samuel's.
Yeah.
So his wife said, you know, hey, you need to not go over there anymore because you're not getting anywhere and you just need to knock it off and just be happy and do what you need to be doing. So he said, okay, well, I'm going to stop going over there. Anyway, he finds out that the boys, the twins, so again, Kathy bears twins and then leaves, and Adam is heartbroken and he's basically withdrawn from life and just goes through the motions, and Lee is taking care of the twins.
Right.
But they've never been named. So Samuel finds out that they haven't been named, and then there's this scene where he goes to his wife and he tells her, "Hey, I'm going to go over there." And he's thinking that she's gonna say no, and he's thinking, you know, what am I going to do? I don't want to have to disobey her, but this is kind of important. And she says to him, "You better go right now, and if they don't have names when you come back, you're going to be in big trouble." But it was a very touching scene between those two, and it was just like, wow, you know, that, you know, so speaking of relationships, that was an incredible relationship that those two had. And and she not only gave him permission, but gave him what he needed so that he could go with his head high.
She knew just how to motivate him.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one other scene where it shows him having to motivate her. And I love the fact that they both knew each other well enough to know. Some people would look at it as manipulation, but they did it for good reasons, and they did it with love, and they did it because they knew each other so well. They knew just what buttons to push to make that person take the route they needed to take. They kind of gave them the permission and the strength and the push.
Mm-hmm.
And even though they're super different, which is pointed out all the time, that worked because of that. And so I really liked that look at a good marriage.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so back to your story.
No, that was the story.
Oh,
so.
Okay. Sorry.
I just, you know, the thing is, this book became for me not only this overall theme of the Cain and Abel and how we as humans are kind of, you know, we have this competitiveness and this jealousy that maybe sprouts from original sin, that we constantly play this story over and over and over. And I mean, this book is true in that, you know, it's like, you know, in fact, there was a quote in here, "No story has power, nor will it last unless we feel in ourselves that it is true and true of us." I can't remember if it was Lee who said that, but this book is that, you know, it just speaks truth the entire time. And, you know, we as humans, you know, we can see in this book, we can see it in our real life. We can see people running through this, and we can see ourselves running through this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just this story that we keep telling as humans over and over and over. So not only was it this big, broad, generational story that showed us that, you know, almost, you know, humanity cyclically doing the same thing over and over, but it was also these little tiny pieces of just things that I had to stop and say, "Wow, that was amazing."
Oh, yeah.
Over and over and over. There's, you know, a little thing here, a little thing there, a little thing here. You know, just these scenes that just blew me away throughout the entire book.
Well, in broad picture, let's look at the fact that I didn't think about this until I was thinking about Liza and Samuel's marriage. We're also shown a lot of ways that marriage is played out.
Yeah,
and,
true.
And does and doesn't work. I mean, the father, Cyrus, his first wife is somebody, well, no one can really relate to him well, but she's kind of a little tight person who, I think she dies. The second wife is kind of mousy and never speaks because he won't let her. Then you see Kathy, who's a total user of people because she's just not normal. And Adam's idealization of her. And then you have Aaron, who's interested in Abra, the girl that they've met. But he's projecting, again, like his father, different needs that he has on her.
Yeah, and you know, I didn't quite make that connection. But yeah, he was doing the same thing Adam did. Even though she was a completely different kind of person, he was building this thing up that didn't exist.
Right. And then... later, they're older, and she can see that he's got some unrealistic way of living in the world at all. He turns into the person who is too good for the world, and nothing in the world can make him happy because everything in the world is dirty.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and then there's Charles, who's really winds up being the most normal person in the whole book, and who she's actually become attracted to because he is normal, and they're probably going to have a fairly healthy relationship because they both understand what is real.
Mm-hmm. You mean Caleb?
That's true. Oh,
Caleb. Yeah, we're getting our C's. No, that's fine. I'm just making sure.
Too many C names and too many people that are
right.
Just
so
close enough. I'm sorry.
Aaron's brother, Caleb, right?
At the end of the book, and it's it's so I was kind of looking at that, just all the different ways to be married and meet somebody and to think about somebody and what do we project on them. And I think part of that is when you first meet somebody, of course, you have all these idealistic views. Mm-hmm. And then the more you're dating and, you know, whatever, and get married, and then you get into marriage and you have kids, and oh my gosh, the layers start getting peeled back, you know? And so if you have a really idealistic view of how things are and it's not based in some kind of real solid truth, no wonder the divorce rate is high.
Right. Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. And if you're looking for something that's not really, well, I guess that's the idealistic part, but if you're looking for something to fulfill something in you that you've got to do yourself, you're depending on someone else to do it. Kind of like that voice talking to Cal at the end, to Caleb.
Yeah.
Going, you know, you're just enjoying this. Be a man.
Yeah.
Get real. Well, right. That thing you said about truth, Steinbeck made two statements. He says, we only have one story. All novels, all poetry are built on the never-ending contest in ourselves of good and evil. And it occurs to me that evil must constantly respawn, while good, while virtue, is immortal. Vice has always a new, fresh, young face, while virtue is venerable as nothing else in the world is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, in a nutshell. And then...
Right. And this, I've got another quote right here that feeds right into that, but you may have the same one.
Go ahead.
It says, humans are caught in their lives, in their thoughts, in their hungers and ambitions, in their avarice and cruelty, and in their kindness and generosity too, in a net of good and evil. I think this is the only story we have, and that it occurs on all levels of feeling and intelligence.
Yep.
Yep. Virtue the next sentence is good too. Virtue and vice were warp and woof of our first consciousness, and they will be the fabric of our last. And this despite any changes we may impose on field and river and mountain, on economy and manners. There is no other story.
Yes, exactly. And that's why this book works, because everything in here is talking about that. And then I have one more thing where Lee is telling Adam the story of his birth, and it's a difficult story. It's probably the hardest story. And I'm glad I wasn't listening, because that's why I started off listening to the audio version you provided. And I was like, whoa, I can't hear all this. I have to just read it. And as a friend of mine pointed out, the best classical literature will tell you hard things, but it allows you to keep a distance from it. So you can kind of look at it and it doesn't just overcome you. And reading this versus listening made it possible for me to do that. But at one point he tells his father, or he tells Adam, he says, you know, we'd get to this point of the story and I knew what was coming next, the really hard part. And he said, he'd tell his father, let's tell it this way. Let's say this happened, and he'd tell a good story. He says, and my father became very Chinese then. He said, there's more beauty in the truth, even if it is dreadful beauty. The storytellers at the city gate twist life so that it looks sweet to the lazy and the stupid and the weak, and this only strengthens their infirmities and teaches nothing, cures nothing, nor does it let the heart soar. And for me, that is something that we are sorely lacking in general today. In our society.
Yeah, I agree.
It made me think also of listening to, I was listening to the first Harry Potter book. And and at one point they're talking at the end, Dumbledore saying, you know, Harry says, oh, well, I mean, you know who. And he says, no, his name is Voldemort. Say it. When you don't use the proper names for what things are, you become afraid of those things. And I thought of all this politically correct speech that we have, and how every time somebody doesn't like the way something is called, they change the name to something that's nicer. And, you know, I don't want to go around insulting people. But on the other hand, when you just keep changing the name for what things are, you take away your ability to look at it and deal with it.
Yeah. You lose what it is that you're talking about.
Right.
Yeah. Without question.
Which kind of takes me, because that words have power. And that kind of takes me back to when you were talking about naming the babies. which is such a key part of the book.
Oh, yeah. And there's another, you know, talking about fantastic scenes, that whole scene.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, it was just, you know, so after Samuel talks to his wife, he ends up going over there. And the first thing he starts to do is fight Adam. He starts to hit him and stuff. And, you know, he gets really upset, which is, you know, not in his character, you know, so.
Right.
But Adam, you know, I think Adam must know what he's doing because he doesn't fight back or anything like that. And then he actually later he thanks him. Yeah, I don't think he could fight back.
I think he was so divorced from anything real.
Yeah.
He wasn't even really conscious.
So, yeah, he was snapping him into reality.
Yeah.
And then, it's while they're sitting there, they're at a table outside, he and Adam, Samuel and Adam. Lee brings the babies out and puts them in the dirt, you know, so they're sitting there playing with sticks and stuff, and they're about a year old. And at this time is when they talked about Cain and Abel for the first time, as they're coming up with names. And, they talked and talked and talked, and then eventually got around to the naming, and that was where they came up with Caleb and Aaron.
But they started naming biblical names.
Mm-hmm, right. Yep, they were going through a few biblical names.
And it was when they'd say a name and one baby would cry and they go, oh, that's his name. He claimed it.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. When they said Caleb, one would cry and he'd say, ah, there you are. Yeah.
And I actually have a couple that we know that are still in the process of having kids. They have, I guess they have four kids and I think another one's on the way now, but they don't name their babies until they're a few days old.
Interesting.
They want to know the personality of the baby before they give it a name or start thinking about names.
Uh-huh.
Which at the time I heard that, I was like, really? Because I was like, what names are you thinking about? Oh, I don't know. We'll think about that after, you know, he's a couple days old. Which is how they have one baby named Atticus. And I'm always like, you like the book? Well, it was in this. Yeah, of course I love the book, but it was in this book of names. And I'm like, it means this. And this baby seems to have this personality. And I went, how biblical.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I hadn't thought about that naming. I mean, I liked the story and I liked the fact of the way they did it. But when you were saying that before, it occurred to me that in the Bible and especially the Old Testament, your name is not just a word. It means something. And that's why you didn't share it with everybody, because it carried the essence of who you are. And that's why God just says, I am, because there's no name we can have that would encapsulate what he is. He is too wild and outside of our understanding.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so if the name is the essence of yourself, I didn't look up Aaron and Caleb, but the fact that they let the babies identify who they were, was interesting. And also, this isn't exactly right, but in Aaron and Caleb, I also saw a reflection of Jacob and Esau.
Okay.
Just in terms of one was simpler and one was tricky. And it's the one that you don't think deserves it that winds up being the one who is actually the favored one. From the way it starts off. And when you delve into it further, a la East of Eden, you can see a lot more of it.
Mm-hmm.
Not that Aaron is exactly an Esau type, but he suddenly starts to go back to that more real elemental thing. It's the wrong elemental, which is kind of the thing that point that's always made about Esau.
Right.
He's almost primitive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've got this naming scene. It's actually kind of short once they actually get to the naming.
Okay.
He says, Adam says, all right, name me some names from the Bible. And the other person who's talking is Samuel. From any place. All right, well, let's see. Of all the people who started out of Egypt, only two came to the promised land. Who would you like them? Would you like them for a symbol? Who? Caleb and Joshua. Joshua was a soldier, a general. I don't like soldiering. Well, Caleb was a captain, but not a general. I kind of like Caleb. Caleb Trask. One of the twins woke up and without interval began to wail. You called his name, said Samuel. You don't like Joshua, and Caleb's named. He's the smart one, the dark one. See, the other one is awake too. Well, Aaron I've always liked, but he didn't make it to the promised land. The second boy almost joyfully began to cry. Ooh. That's good enough, said Adam. Yeah, and you know, that's interesting. So Samuel actually named Aaron.
And he didn't make it to the promised land.
Interesting. Yeah.
Heavy. Whoa. When you think about him.
Yeah. Oh. How about that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Now I got to read the whole book over again. Fantastic.
I know. It's kind of
neat.
Wow. It's amazing. Yeah. I've put in on paperback swap to see if a copy turns up.
Oh, I was surely like, they will. Yeah. Yeah, surely.
But I also liked the way, this goes away from the naming, but Liza and Samuel, the husband and wife. And I think it's kind of, maybe this is just me. It's, the way he tells about them is kind of the two different ways that people think about their faith or God or whatever. And it says, you know, because Liz is just down to earth, practical. She doesn't worry about a lot of thinking. The Bible says it. And she's like, that's just how it is. And it says, it was talking about Una, one of their children, died.
Right, yeah.
It says it cut the earth from under Samuel's feet and opened his defended keep and let in old age. And it said Liza loved her family as deeply as her husband, but she felt the sorrow, but she survived it. And then, if I could read this, he says, I think perhaps Liza accepted the world as she accepted the Bible with all of its paradoxes and its reverses. She did not like death, but she knew it existed. And when it came, it did not surprise her. Samuel may have thought and played and philosophized about death, but he did not really believe in it. His world did not have death as a member. He and all around him was immortal. When real death came, it was an outrage, a denial of the immorality he deeply felt, and the one crack in his wall caused the whole structure to crash. I think he had always thought he could argue himself out of death. It was a personal opponent and one he could lick. To Liza, it was simply death, a thing promised and expected. She could go on and in her sorrow, put a pot of beans in the oven, bake 6 pies, and plan to exactness how much food would be necessary to properly feed the funeral guests. And she could, in her sorrow, see that Samuel had a clean white shirt, blah, blah, blah. Perhaps it takes these two kinds to make a good marriage, riveted with several kinds of strength. Once Samuel accepted, he could probably go farther than Liza, but the process of accepting tore him to pieces.
Yeah.
And it's funny because of course, all those details don't apply to each person, but Tom is like Liza, my husband. I can talk to him about all this stuff and he's, oh yeah, and he'll talk to me about it. But when it comes down to it, he doesn't worry about it. He just, oh. This is what the church teaches. It makes sense to me. It's very logical. I'm going to follow their rules.
Yeah, yeah.
He doesn't do it without thinking, but he's like Liza. He's like, well, okay, this works, this doesn't. But, you know, I understand why people don't like it. But to me, it makes sense. So, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think about it more.
Right. And thus we're here.
And for a long time, I
guess.
Yeah,
yeah. So. Well, good.
Well, since we're here, anything else? Go ahead.
Yeah, that's what I was just wondering. Should we wrap up the discussion? Do you have anything else you'd like to say about the book?
I actually think I'm surprised. I think we kind of covered it.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much in here. I mean, we could start a whole other conversation, I'm sure. But
yeah, but the big stuff.
Yeah, well, we talked about the big rocks.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of like Genesis. You know, I really would encourage people, you know, if you want to read this, but then read Genesis too, because it's much more of a people story than you think.
Cool. Yeah, I've got one other thing to talk about here. There's a book. I wanted to finish this book before this podcast, but I didn't. It's called Journal of a Novel. And it turns out that this is not the kind of a book you read cover to cover. I think I'll read this much like you read Flannery O'Connor's Habit of Being.
Yeah, a little at a time.
Yeah, but what this book is, it says, each working day from January 29th to November 1st, 1951, John Steinbeck warmed up to the work of writing East of Eden with a letter to the late Pascal Covici, his friend and editor at Viking Press. It was his way, he said, of getting my mental arm in shape to pitch a good game. Steinbeck's letters were written on the left-hand pages of a notebook in which the facing pages would be filled with the text of East of Eden. They touched on many subjects, story arguments, trial flights of workmanship, concern for his sons. Part autobiography, part writer's workshop, these letters offer an illuminating perspective on Steinbeck's creative process. So I just found this part. This is right when, I'll just read it because it's interesting. This is on June 22nd, a Friday. And at the end of this journal entry, he says, "Now there you have it. And I wonder if it has possibly the little perfume I wanted it to have. On Monday, Samuel will visit Adam Trask and the twins and Lee again, and that will be the last of him. But he must leave a light, as the litany says, to lighten the Gentiles. And that's all now. You'll have 10 more pages next week." And that's interesting. And then the next day, this is really interesting too. June 25th, Monday. I fell to pieces this weekend. Got full of congestions and aches that I couldn't shake. Horrible dreams and many aches. I think just a very bad cold with nervousness. The boys have a transition to make, and so do we. Ordinarily, I have two complete lives to lead, book life and other, and now I have three. I do not change very easily. I get into the most trouble when I'm not working actively, but that's always so. Tom needs camp very badly. He needs the supervision of older boys. In many ways, he is a baby, less old than he should be. This grows from a frantic desire to be appreciated. He tries to be like Catbird. And like most humans, some of his methods of attracting attention are pretty unattractive and nerve-wracking." And then he goes on. So he's talking about his son.
Wow, what insight.
Yeah. "Now I will try to get back to work. Samuel has now to meet Adam Trask and Lee for the last time. I want to make a fine thing of this. I will tell you now what I intend. I want Samuel to become a kind of huge figure of folklore. For that reason, I am not going to take the reader to his death. I have already described it earlier in the book. I will only report it in this part. In this way, I will keep him partly alive, like a frog's heart in saline solution, or like the memory of a man." So, yeah, this is going to be neat. But you can see that I can't read this cover to cover. This is going to be kind of a, read it in little pieces.
Yeah, I think Flannery O'Connor, I read a little bit every day for probably over a year. It's a huge book. Mm-hmm. And those were her letters to friends and people that she was advising. But so you'll put the link for that because that sounds like an interesting book.
Yeah, it's called Journal of a Novel, The East of Eden Letters by John Steinbeck. Okay.
Well, and not only does that's interesting that he put so much of himself into it because from the introduction to this, which I only read part of because partway into it, they started analyzing the book and I was like, no, thanks. I'll do that myself. Mm-hmm. But it talks about the fact that it was published in 1939 and it was banned in Illinois and reviled as filthy in Washington, D.C. The First Lady Roosevelt and her husband read and publicly spoke about it. And I'm like, 1939?
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense.
Holy. Think about some
but
of this stuff.
But it was written in 51, though.
Well.
So there must be something wrong with that.
That must be a typo.
Yeah.
Oh, The Grapes of Wrath. Sorry.
Grapes of Wrath.
I misread this.
All right.
Okay. The Grapes of Wrath was done in 1939. Mm-hmm. Reviled as filthy. Okay. So I misread that. But so then what happens is he didn't sit down to write this until 1951. Mm-hmm. He says, but he began thinking about it almost as soon as he finished The Grapes of Wrath. So he said he saw it not as another book, but a better one.
Right. And it probably is. I think it is a better one.
"I've been practicing for a book for 35 years, he wrote in 1949, and this is it. I don't see how it can be popular because I am inventing method and form and tone and context. All else had been apprenticeship."
How about that? Yeah, here, the very first entry in this journal of a novel, it says... I skipped a couple paragraphs, but it says, "We come now to the book. It has been planned a long time. I planned it when I didn't know what it was about. I developed a language for it that I will never use. This seems such a waste of the few years a man has to write in. And still, I do not think I could have written it before now. Of course, it would have been a book, but not this book. I remember when you gave me this thick, black, expensive book to write in. See how well I have kept it for this book. Only 6 pages are out of it. A puppy gnawed the corners of the front cover, and it is clean and fresh and open. I hope I can fill it as you would like it filled.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And the critics were really divided. It says, some people really liked it, but they didn't like this theory of monsters. Mm. But, you know, but it says his obsession, but the Christian Science Monitor said his obsession with naked animality, I guess, brute violence, and the dark wickedness of the human mind remains so overriding that what there is of beauty and understanding is subordinated and almost extinguished. Hmm. And a lot of people hated it. But I looked at that and I thought, well, that's read Genesis again.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it doesn't go into maybe some of the thinking and the details that this book does, but there is a lot of awful stuff in that book because that's human behavior.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah, it just goes back to what you were saying about calling things what they are.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, and it's that thing the Chinese father says, or that he has Lee's father say, which is that you can't get to the beauty of truth unless you go through the hard stuff of truth, basically.
Right.
And that's why this book has hope and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
It shows us the light and the goodness. And speaking of Samuel as being, you know, he makes him to be a prophet. And I loved his little joke that he said his wife absolutely hates it when she says, she'll, Samuel, and he says, here am I, which is what Samuel said to God when he called him at the temple.
Yeah. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
All right.
So.
Well, good. Another one down.
Yeah. Wow. This is, we need something less long.
Yeah. So you betcha. So yeah, I'm going to owe you a couple short ones because Declare is not a short book either. The next ones, I promise, they'll be so short. It'll be like a index card or something.
Well, okay, then it'll be that short. But, well, maybe the Agatha Christie coming up will be enough.
That's for sure.
Antidote.
That's great. Yeah, so what is coming up? We've got the next
Inception.
Movie. Yes, that's right, Inception.
Which is also brain bender.
Oh, that's fun.
It's a great movie, but boy, mm-hmm. you have to be alert and think the whole time.
That's cool. So that... And then There Were None by Agatha Christie.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic.
Also looking at evil.
Uh-huh.
But much more, I don't know if it's lightly, but it's certainly not at the length that Steinbeck did.
Uh-huh. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And then Contact.
Right.
Movie. And Declare by Tim Powers.
Right.
So those are our next few. And then I'm still anxiously awaiting your October.
I know. I can't decide whether I've got 3 choices each for book and movie.
Mm-hmm.
I can't decide whether to go light or heavy. I may tell you my choices and let you pick.
Oh, sounds good.
No, we'll see.
Well, I'm up for anything. Yep, I owe you one for this one.
Well, we'll see. Mm-hmm. And then what was I going to say, though, about... Shoot. Oh, well, it's gone. Oh, no, I was just rereading The Atrocity Archives by Charles Stross.
Stross, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Stross.
Uh-huh.
And which is, you know, a spy novel written as if Lovecraft's hideous others from parallel universes were out there and people could discover them through mathematics and accidentally let them in. And so they're constantly having to go clean up people's messes. And I was looking at the afterword written in 2003, where a friend had told Charles Stross, you haven't read Declare by Tim Powers, have you? While he was writing that book. And he goes, no. And he goes, well, don't read it. Finish your book. And he said, I'm so glad he told me that, because then he went and read it and he said, it's about a very similar concept. He goes, but it's written in homage to a different style of spy story.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I thought, oh, I'm kind of prepared.
Yeah.
For, cool. you know, here's the other way of looking at it.
Yeah. Nice.
And he goes, somebody had said they thought that Tim Powers had more hope and optimism. I don't know if that's true or not, because I've never read it. But
yeah, we'll find out.
Yeah,
that's great.
Anyway. All right.
Well, we'll see you in a couple of weeks for Inception.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Yeah. Thanks, everyone. Okay. It was a long one.
You bet.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.